Okay. So, this morning I was going to finish off very quickly about the idea of generosity as part of right view. So just finishing that off, and then we'll start on the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path just after that. So, I just want to very briefly have a look at Majjhima Nikaya 141. This is the Dakkhina Vibhanga Sutta, exposition on offerings. And this is just a small extract from that sutta. It's a long sutta about offering, and one of the important points that is made in the sutta is that offering to the Sangha is always more powerful than offering to any kind of individual. So much so that the Buddha, he says to his own foster mother, to Mahaprajapati, Gautami, he tells her that, you know, even to me, don't offer to me, offer to the whole Sangha. Even to that extent, it is better to offer to the Sangha, which is very, very interesting here. But just very briefly, this first point here is also interesting, and I'll just read it out to you. There are seven kinds of offerings made to the Sangha, Ananda. One gives a gift to a Sangha of both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, headed by the Buddha. This is the first kind of offering made to the Sangha. One gives a gift to the Sangha of both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, after the Tathagata has attained final Nibbana. This is the second kind of offering made to the Sangha. So the highest gift in Buddhism is a gift that is first of all given to both Sanghas together with the Buddha. And if the Buddha has passed away, then the highest gift becomes the gift that is given to both Sanghas or both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. So good, interesting to notice that and to keep that in mind when one does acts of charity. Instead of giving to individuals, the ideal way is to give to both Sanghas. Okay, the next sutta, I said I was going to do this fairly quickly. The next sutta, I'm just going to not going to read out the whole thing. I'll just explain to you very briefly what is going on. And this is Venerable Sariputta asking the Buddha about when is giving of great fruit and when is giving not such great fruit. And what you will see in the sutta is that if you give a gift and you have some kind of desire or expectation of having some kind of reward or something in return, in other words, you give, the mind isn't entirely pure, there's a defilement in the mind, that is when the giving is not as powerful. The more pure the mind is, and all of these things you see in the suttas are basically degrees of impurity. There's a certain amount you do things just out of tradition, right, because you're holding on to tradition or whatever. And eventually you reach the stage where you give simply, first of all, because the mind becomes happy and glad, right? This is one of the highest ways of giving. You give just so that you can feel a sense of happiness as a consequence. And finally, the highest way of giving is where you give simply because you give because you know that this will be a source for you to move towards Nibbana much more quickly. It says here, it is a parikara. It is a requisite for the mind. Parikara, chitta parikara, a requisite for the mind. It's something you use to move you forward on the path to move towards awakening more quickly. This is the ideal way, right? There's no defilement there anymore. There's no desire for rebirth. There's no desire for anything here. All you want is to have something that aids you towards awakening experience. So, and this is a very important point. So please remember this, that whenever we do things, it is the purity of the mind that ultimately decides the type of karma that we are making here. And I will look a bit more at that as we start looking at right speech and right action and these things very, very soon. Okay, one couple of last short suttas on generosity. One is called A Blaze. I will read this one out for you. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Savati in Jeta's Grove and at Anathapindika's Park. Then, when the night had advanced, a certain devata of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire Jeta's Grove, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, stood to one side, and recited these verses in the presence of the Blessed One. When one's house is ablaze, the vessel taken out is the one that is useful, not the one left burnt inside. So when the world is ablaze with the fires of old age and death, one should take out one's wealth by giving. What is given is well salvaged. What is given yields pleasant fruit, but not so what is not given. Thieves take it away, or kings, it gets burnt by fire or is lost. Then in the end one leaves the body along with one's possessions. Having understood this, the wise person should enjoy himself, but also give. Having given and enjoyed as fits his means, blameless he goes to the heavenly state. So this nice idea about, nice little simile about how you should use your wealth, right? If you don't use it in the right way, it becomes like the vessel that is burnt inside the house. It is useless, instead of taking the vessel out so it can become useful. A very nice little metaphor or simile for how wealth is well spent. And the last one is from the Dhammapada 118. And it goes as follows. Have you got that in there, or is it missing in your thing here? It's missing. Okay. I will just read it out for you then here. Should a person do good? Good here is punya. Should a person do punya? Let him do it again and again. Let him find pleasure therein, for blissful is the accumulation of punya. Right? It is blissful. That's why we do these things. You feel happy inside. So you do it again and again and again. Never stop. Every opportunity you take. It is not often about the size of the generosity or the amount of generosity. It is often about how often we do these things. Often small things are often good enough. Or not good enough. They're even better because they're kind of heading in the right direction all the time as you do that. So that is about generosity. I'm going through fairly fast because we just can't go through everything in such great detail. Otherwise, we would be here, have to take another week, which which maybe that would be nice, but unfortunately, it's going to be hard to do that. The idea here, again, is this idea of generosity being so foundational on the Buddhist path that is talked about in right view at the very beginning here. And please remember that. And this is not just for lay people, it is for monastics as well. And one of the great things about living the monastic life, in my opinion, that the monastic life is almost like an expression of generosity. We don't really have an income. Nobody's paying us for being monks, right? Yes, people support, if we live the life well, people will support us with the basic requisites, and that's wonderful. But we don't really have an income. So whenever we do something for the world, whenever we give a teaching, whenever you build something, whenever you help out with somebody, go to visit them in hospital or whatever it is always an act of charity, in a sense. You don't do it expecting anything in return. And that is such a wonderful thing when you do things without expecting anything in return. It means everything becomes an act of charity. Giving a teaching, giving a talk, and it becomes much more beautiful that way. And it becomes much more powerful. You know, you give a teaching and you do it simply because an act of charity. It means also you can relax more, right? You come wherever you travel in the world, you do it just out of kindness. It doesn't really matter so much if people don't like what you say. It's okay. It doesn't matter. If they like what you say, even better. But actually, it doesn't matter that much. And then you can feel more at ease doing these kind of things. And it actually creates more positive results for you in the long run. So your whole life turns into an act of charity. And you can feel happiness about almost everything you do when you do it in that way. And for lay people too, it's a similar kind of thing. You can almost turn your life into an act of charity. For example, and one of the examples would be when you go to work. Of course, normally you work for money. And of course, that is one of the benefits of working. But you can expand that idea. It's not just for money. You can expand the idea out and think of work as something you do also to help the customer, to help your colleagues, right? To help the company to prosper in the world. So you have this bigger idea. It's not just for the money. It's also to actually be of assistance to the world. And a company that is well run, that makes a useful product, certainly it is of assistance, right? It is helping society forward. If you do it just for the money, it becomes very limited and very kind of greedy and selfish. But if you do it with this bigger view in mind, it becomes much more beautiful, and there's more sense of generosity and kindness there. And so we can do with everything in family life, in everything, we can include this act of being kind, doing things for the right reasons, as a gift, as an act of charity. And life itself becomes just a sense of giving. And then the happiness you get from that is so much greater. It's one of the weird things, right? If you really want to be selfish, you can't be selfish. Right? If you really want to create happiness for yourself, which people would say, oh, you're just so selfish because you're looking for your own happiness. But actually, if you really want to be selfish, if you really want to create happiness for yourself, you should be unselfish, and you should, you know, be charitable instead. Okay, so now that is a right view on the Buddhist path. And now we will move on to right intention, Samma Sankappa. And I'm going to talk about this only very briefly. So right intention can also be translated, Samma Sankappa can also be translated as right aim, right purpose, right? Once you have a certain view, it's like your aim in life, your purpose in life shifts to a different direction. And this is why there is this connection between view and what we actually want to do, how we want to live our lives. Our aims, our purpose in life is controlled to a very large extent by our views. And so how does this work? Well, when you have the view that there is results of your actions, right? There is kamma vipaka, there is generosity, there is mother and father, it's all basically about the same kind of thing. Of course, once you have that view, then you tend to steer your mind towards the aim of being kind, right? Of doing the right thing. And this is why Samma Sankappa is all a lot about kindness of the heart. So that is fairly obvious. But on a deeper level, it also means that once you understand that there is a problem in the world, there is this samsara going around and around, continuing from life to life, you get weary of this whole thing, and you want to enter upon a spiritual path that leads to the ending of all of this. Of course, this only becomes really powerful once you become an Arya, but even before you become an Arya, you can start to get a feeling for how this works. And you want to purify yourself because you know that it is through purity that you can actually... there's many reasons for that. One of the reasons is that the clarity of the mind only really comes as a consequence of purity. If there's too many impurities in the mind, you will be clouded. You won't be able to see straight, right? So you want to straighten up the mind. It's called the Ujjucitta in the suttas. Ujjucitta is a straight mind which sees things straight. It is not clouded by the defilements. So this is the second reason. You understand that to be able to leave samsara behind, to attain the deep states of samadhi and to see things clearly, the only way to do that is to aim for purification. So this is what you're doing here. You understand that the purpose of life becomes to purify yourself and eventually gain these insights on the path. So this then is the right intention or right aim or right purpose, Samma Sankappa, is defined in the sutta called Analysis, again from the Magga Sanyutta, Sanyutta Nikaya, the 45th Sanyutta. And what, bhikkhus, is this right aim or right intention? It is the purpose of renunciation, the purpose of non-ill will, and the purpose of harmlessness. This is called right intention. So this is what it is. The purpose in life changes, and this becomes our purpose all of a sudden. And you can see all of this is about doing what is right in the world. The two most obvious ones to understand here is the intention of non-ill will. It is very similar to the intention of metta. Not exactly the same, but very similar here. So you're moving towards metta, kindness. And then you have the second one, which is the intention of harmlessness. So this is vihinsa, or avihinsa is harmlessness, or ahinsa. Hinsa or vihinsa are these things which means being harmful, or being cruel, or being pitiless, being ruthless in the world. That is what vihingsa means. So this is the opposite of that, right? So this is, means that you have, the opposite of that is being compassionate. I looked up the word ruthless a while ago, and I realized there was another word called ruthful. Have you ever heard the word ruthful before? So the idea of ruth is, it's a word which actually means compassion. So if you are ruthful, you are full of compassion. This was a word that was apparently used in English back in the 17th century or something, so if you haven't heard it, it's not very strange. But actually there is that contrast between ruthless on the one hand and ruthful on the other one. So here we can translate the intention of ruthfulness. That would be a bit of an innovation. But anyway, the idea is here that, you know, often people can be ruthless in their lives. Ruthless means that you are cold about the feelings of other people. You don't care if others suffer. You look at yourself, what you want to do in the world, and if others suffer, well, that's tough luck for those people. So coldness, being callous, being hard-hearted, right? And this is the opposite of that, having compassion instead. This is what this actually refers to. It's a bit different from ill will, but you can see how it is similar in a sense. Now this becomes your aim in life, the purpose in life. And then the last one is the intention of renunciation, and this is this is more profound. What this really means is nekama sankapa, and nekama is the opposite of karma. Karma is the desire for the sensual pleasures in the world. Nekama is the giving up of those sensual pleasures in the world. So why would anybody want to aim for that? You know, this is what people often ask. Why do you want to aim for that? You know, aiming to abandon all your happiness if you aim for the nekama sankapa. Surely that is not a very wise approach. So why do we do that? Well, the reason you do that is, again, you recognize, first of all, that if you have a lot of desire, it actually ends up causing problems in the world. Desire and anger, desire and ill will are often very closely linked to each other. You don't get your desires fulfilled, it means often you become angry and have ill will as a consequence. These are very closely related to each other. And you can see that in your own life, how desire makes you frustrated, makes life difficult, and it causes all kinds of problems. So if you want to have a life where you're going to live at peace, when you're going to live in harmony with other people, you're going to have to reduce the desires and therefore move in the direction of nekama. I will look at this a little bit more later on when we go on to the sammapadana part of the path. This is the first thing you recognize, right? This is about morality. But the second thing that you realize is that desire distorts your mind. You cannot see clearly. You're not going to be able to find the purity of the mind, to find the insights you need to attain awakening as long as there is desire in the heart. Desire distorts everything. You don't see things in accordance with reality. And this then becomes an incredible problem. So you realize the only way to be able to abandon this samsara is to purify yourself, get rid of these things. The mind becomes clear. You can actually see things in the right way and not through the distorted lens of desire. So there's always these two things here, right? There's the kind of the small picture where you just understand that morality is important, and then there's the big picture of understanding that really what you want to do is to be on the path of purity, to purify yourself. You understand this becomes the purpose of the life. Basically, that's what you understand. So that is samma sankappa, right purpose, right aim. So right view leads to right aim, right? Like I was saying before, if you have the view that the shop is to the right, and then your aim becomes, you want to walk towards the shop, so your aim becomes to walk to the right. You're heading in the right direction. And that is, of course, will then become a source for happiness in the future. If you have wrong sankapa, miksha sankapa, then it will lead to suffering as a consequence. So that is right aim. So once the right aim is in place, then we can move on. Of course, then we start to purify ourselves. We start to act in accordance with that right aim. And the basic purification, the most simple purification, is of course our actions and our speech. That is the most simple thing. So from having the right aim, we start with the coarser forms of problems that we have, and that is the speech and the action. In the Noble Eightfold Path, speech comes before action. Sammavacha comes before Sammakamanta. Why that is, I'm not sure. Other places in the path, Kamanta comes first, Vacha comes afterwards. It's a little bit, I'm not clear exactly why that is. And I think basically, it probably the two go together. And there isn't any clear sequence between the two. It is just part of how we purify our sila. Anyway, Sammavacha comes first on the Noble Eightfold Path. So let's have a look at Sammavacha, right speech. And this is how it is analyzed. And what, bhikkhus, is right speech? Abstinence from false speech, abstinence from divisive speech, abstinence from harsh speech, and abstinence from idle chatter. This is called right speech. Okay, so let's have a look at this in a little bit more detail to understand what this actually refers to. And I will go back again now to Majjhima Nikaya 41, the Salayaka Sutta, the Brahmins of Sala. And this is the sutta which talks about the Dasa Kusala Kamapata and also the Dasa Akusala Kamapata, the 10 ways of wholesome action and the 10 ways of unwholesome action. Four of these 10 ways have to do with speech, and here it is explained in a bit more detail. So this is the Kusala Kamapata. This is the positive side, right? Okay, so we abandon false speech. I haven't mentioned the negative side here, because sometimes it's more inspiring, I find, to look at the positive side instead. So this is how we should be speaking. Abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. He speaks truth, adheres to the truth, is trustworthy and reliable, one who is no deceiver of the world. So this is the how to practice right speech in relation to musavada, in relation to lying. So not only do you notice here, not only do you avoid lying, but you actually deliberately make sure that you tell the truth and you speak in a way that is reliable and trustworthy. You don't try to get away with things, right? How can I lie without lying, kind of thing, right? You know what I mean? How can I kind of avoid telling the truth but not actually breaking the precept? In reality, if you try to live like that, you're not really fulfilling the precept as you should be doing it. You should actually be trustworthy and reliable. So one of the important points here, and this is one of the points I was talking about yesterday, is that in all of this, the degree to which your speech is good or bad is not just about whether you fulfill the precept or not. It's about your intention. Where are you coming from? Why are you lying? Is a very important part of this. So, for example, this is what it says in the elsewhere where this is defined. It says that if you are summoned, right, you are asked to come in front of a court of law, and the judge says to you, speak the truth. You know, have you seen this or have you not seen this? Do you know this or do you not know this? And then you deliberately lie in a court of law where you have pledged to tell the truth. That is the kind of lying which is very serious, right? Or you lie in the world, you have a strong desire, you want to get something for yourself, or you want to hurt somebody, and you lie with the motivation of hurting somebody else, or because you have a desire to get something. This is the kind of lying which is very bad, because it comes from a root, it comes from a motivation which is bad. This is very important to understand, because it is not as if the precepts are not either you keep it or you don't keep it. There are all kind of degrees to the extent that you keep the precept, right? And this is kind of the very important point here. So the most important type of lying to avoid is the kind of lying where it really is coming from a very negative motivation. And then we might ask yourself, are there circumstances in which lying are acceptable? Are there such circumstances? And perhaps there are, perhaps in certain extreme situations whereby you might hurt the other person very, very badly if you tell the truth, right? And you feel that perhaps I can't tell the truth now, I will let him know the truth later on, because now is not the right time, and because you might hurt them a lot. So in a sense, you're coming from compassion, and you know from wisdom, this is not the right time, there may be another time. Then perhaps in those situations it is okay to say something which isn't quite true. ideally, you don't lie then either. Ideally, you say, okay, this is not the right time to talk about this. We can talk about this later, or you just remain silent. But even if you were to lie in that kind of situation, it is a very different kind of lying from the lying where you are. It's a very serious lie when you're coming from anger, deliberately wanting to hurt somebody. That is the really bad kind of lie. So remember that. The idea with the five precepts is that they are kind of guidelines. The five precepts tells you, if you're going to lie, you've got to be very, very careful. Lying is usually bad. It usually leads in the wrong direction. So if you think that in a certain situation it may be acceptable to lie, you should watch yourself and be very, very careful whether it might be acceptable in that situation. This is especially for So you have to be very careful. This is what the five precepts tell you. If you are going to break them, then only if the situation is absolutely right should you break the five precepts. Only if you are sure that you're coming from compassion. It shouldn't be an excuse, right? I'm coming from compassion, it's okay. That's not good enough, right? You have to really look inside your heart. Where am I coming from? What is motivating me in this particular case? So this is very important. Sometimes we kind of hold on too much to the five precepts or the eight precepts or whatever it is, and thinking that this is an absolute guideline. This is not the absolute guideline. These are approximations to what is a much deeper understanding of morality on the Buddhist path. And this is one of the great things about Buddhist morality. When you go to the essence of what it is about what drives us in our actions, in our speech, in our thoughts. And it's a very flexible system of morality. It basically works on psychology, right? What is our mental state behind the things that we're doing here? And because it is so flexible and because it is based on psychology, it is a system that is very adaptable to all kinds of ethical dilemmas. In the modern world, I don't know about here in Sri Lanka, but a lot in the Western world, you have things like euthanasia are being debated, right? Euthanasia means if somebody says, I want to die, the question is, do they have the right to die? Can a doctor help them to die if they really want to die? You know, if you're very, very old and your body is falling apart and you're just lying there moaning all the time and you know that in 3 weeks you will die anyway, then is it reasonable? Is it compassionate to help the person die? Or should they continue living on for those 3 or 4 weeks extra? This is the kind of question that come up. And here, this is the place where, as Buddhists, we have this wonderful ethical system which works directly on psychology. What is the motivation? What is the driving force that allows you for this person to die? And if the driving force is compassion, if it is wisdom, then, according to Buddhist ethics, it would be acceptable, right? So we just need to be very careful with looking into our mind, very careful with making sure that we are doing it for the right reasons. And if we are, then things which might seem to go against the five precepts actually might be ethically acceptable. So very, very adaptable system of ethics, and it can be used almost to sort out all ethical dilemmas that we are faced with in the modern world. And I think this is one of the great things that Buddhism actually has to contribute to modern, very profound questions that are very difficult to answer, especially in traditional Western religions such as Christianity. Very, very, very difficult for these religions to deal with these kind of questions. And this contribution from Buddhism is often very useful, basically. We have something to add to these things. So this is important to remember. So remember that the precepts are approximations. They are very, very useful guidelines, but they are only approximations. In the end, you have to go back to these things called the hetu. This is what you find in the Anguttara, the Tika Nipata. It talks about the hetus, the roots, the motivation, the driving force that makes us act. So just very briefly, in Buddhist ethics, you have the action itself, right? You do something here. So every time you do something, you have to ask yourself, is there intention behind that action? If there is intention in the action, then that action becomes ethically significant. If there is no intention, if you're just walking around and you step on an ant, right, the ant dies, there's no intention, it is ethically it has no significance. But once you intentionally step on that ant, then it becomes ethically significant. So this is the first thing. Action, then is there intention or not? If there is intention, the next question is, what is the motivation? What is the source of that intention? What drives that intention? Does it come from an unwholesome mindset? Loba, dosa, moha. Is that where it comes from? Or does it come from an wholesome mindset? Aloba, adosa, amoha. And that is how you then decide whether what kind of karma you are making here. This is the Buddhist ethics. Action, intention, motivation all have to work together like that. And this is true for all factors of speech and also action. So I find this very interesting because it really makes the Buddhist ethics a very profound and very, 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 very useful teaching for how to deal with all kinds of phenomena in the world. Okay, so that is about lying. And the next one then is the other three types of a right speech or wrong speech, depending on which side you look at it from. So this is the right speech, not doing malicious speech. Abandoning malicious speech, he abstains from malicious speech. He does not repeat elsewhere what he has heard here in order to divide those people from these. Nor does he repeat to these people what he has heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those. Thus he is one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendship, who enjoys concord or harmony. This is Samagga. Enjoys concord and harmony, rejoices in harmony, delights in harmony, a speaker of words that promote harmony. It's nice, isn't it? It's just this. It just has a very nice feel about it. You speak words that create harmony in the world. You don't say things that divide people from this person to that one. It is so very, very common in the world that people talk negative things about others. And whenever you say something negative about somebody else to somebody, you're creating a little bit of a split there, right? Because you are reinforcing a bad impression about the other person, and so you're creating a split between the person you're talking to and the one you're talking about. So it is often much more useful to try to see the positive in people and talk about that instead. Or if there is something negative, to try to understand why and to explain why it is negative instead of talking about negative things. And when you can explain why and you can see the positive, then you can create harmony, samagga, rather than vagga. Vagga is dividing people apart. So avoid the vagga and go for the samagga instead. This is malicious speech. So that is pisuna vacha. And then we have harsh speech, the next one here. Abandoning harsh speech, he abstains from harsh speech. He speaks such words as are gentle, pleasing to the ear, lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by the many, and agreeable to the many. This is parusa vacha. Parusa vacha is harsh speech in Pali. And so here, again, the opposite of harsh speech is speaking in a gentle way, right? Such words that are pleasing to the ear, kanna sukha, happy to the ear, quite literally, pleasing to the ear, lovable, as go to the heart, hadayagama, or something like that, going to the heart. Are courteous, desired by the many, agreeable to the many. Again, very beautiful, isn't it? This idea of speaking in a gentle way, not being harsh with people, but always being gentle. Even if you have to tell somebody off and say something which is a little bit difficult to say, you say it in a gentle way. It's amazing, if you say things that are difficult to say in a gentle way, people will often listen to you because they know that you have their best interest at heart, right? So they will listen to what you're saying. If you say something in a harsh way, they often become defensive. They don't want to listen. They're not interested in what you have to say. So we're kind of opening up the hearts of others by being gentle. Now, one of the interesting things about harsh speech, and this is mentioned elsewhere, is that it takes you away from samadhi. A samadhi sangvattanika, or something like that. it leads away from samadhi here, right? So there's something about harsh speech which kind of agitates the mind, makes the mind not peaceful. Whereas gentle speech then has the opposite effect. If you are gentle, it kind of soothes everything down. Everything becomes nice and peaceful and soothing, and you feel a sense of ease inside of yourself. So this is the kind of speech that leads you towards samadhi. That doesn't mean that harsh speech is any worse karma than false speech or malicious speech. It just means at the moment when you speak it, it takes you away from samadhi. In terms of the degree of bad karma here, everything in Buddhism is usually organized according to according to a natural sequence. So here, false speech is the worst kind of speech, right? Malicious speech is the second kind of worst kind of speech. The third kind is harsh speech. And then you have the last one, which is idle chatter at the end. So that is the sequence. So this is how you have a rough idea what is the worst thing here. And isn't it good that idle chatter is the least bad one? Because if that was the worst one, many people would be in trouble here. So this is the last one here. Please remember that it doesn't mean that we have to kind of go around being glum and silent all the time. We can never be friendly to each other. That is not what abandoning idle chatter means. It says gossip here, but I think idle chatter is a much better translation. It's not just about gossiping, it's about any kind of idle chatter here. It means, even the Buddha in the suttas, right, when he meets the monks, he says, how are you? Are you keeping well? Are you getting enough alms food, right? There's a very friendly atmosphere when the Buddha meets his monks. So that kind of friendliness is, of course, important. We shouldn't, try to be silent at all times. But anyway, let's have a look at what it says here about idle chatter here. Abandoning idle chatter, he abstains from idle chatter here. He speaks at the right time, speaks what is fact, speaks on what is good, speaks on the Dhamma and the discipline. At the right time, he speaks such words as are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. Again, it is a very high standard, right, for how we're supposed to speak. But if we can follow this kind of thing, it becomes very nice. You speak at the right time. You know when people are receptive to what you're going to say, right? You know that there are times when people are not receptive, they are too busy or whatever. You know the right time to speak. This is an important thing, to feel out the right time. If you're going to speak Dhamma, people have to be ready for that. You can't speak Dhamma at any time. People have to be in the right state of mind, in the right place. That is when you speak Dhamma. You speak what is fact. Well, that's of course, you don't talk about nonsense. You speak about real things. You speak on what is good. I think you speak on Atta Sanghita, connected with what is the beneficial, what is the goal, what is good, Atta Sanghita. So, you speak on that, right? What is beneficial in the world? What will help people? Help yourself? What will bring you forward on the path? What will make you more happy? Bring you towards samadhi? Bring you towards nibbana? This is all atta sanghita. You speak on the Dhamma and discipline. So Dhamma is the discourses of the Buddha. Atta and Dhamma are very closely related to each other. The Dhamma is the doctrine. The Dhamma is what you read in the suttas. The Atta is the benefit that the Dhamma gives. Right? So you start off with the doctrine, you apply the doctrine, and then you get the Atta as a consequence of that. So these are related to each other. So you speak on the Dhamma, right? And the discipline, it says here, this is the Vinaya. Now, this is one of my theories. I haven't really studied this in great depth, so I can't actually give any absolute assurance that this is 100% right. But the word Vinaya, of course, in Buddhism, the Vinaya comes to be understood as the Vinaya Pitaka, right? The whole monastic a code of conduct and the monastic procedures like the Upasampada, the Uposatha ceremony, Patimokkha recitation, all these kind of things, the Dandakammas and all these kind of things that you have in the Vinaya. So later on, it comes to mean quite specifically the discipline of the monastics. But in the earliest suttas, the word Vinaya does not seem to be used quite in that way. In the early suttas, it talks about the Patimokkha, right? Keeping the precepts of the Patimokkha. And the Vinaya, as far as I can see in the suttas, is related to the verb Vineti. And the word vineti means to train somebody. You vineti a horse. You train a horse. And for this reason, I understand more, perhaps a better translation, if you just look at the suttas, would be the training here. Right? So discipline is perhaps too limited. It kind of gives us this idea of rules, right? Of following a rigid regime or whatever. But I think training is probably a more appropriate word, or vinaya, in the way it is used in the suttas. And that makes it much broader. It doesn't just mean following rules. It means the whole training of the gradual path, right? From the very beginning, when you become a monk or you become a lay disciple, and you practice all the way to the end with all the different factors. All of that is part of the vinaya, as far as I can see, in the suttas. So then the compound Dhamma vinaya then becomes very meaningful. Then the compound Dhamma vinaya means, on the one hand, the doctrine, right, the teaching that the Buddha gives you, and then the vinaya is the training that comes from that doctrine. So you have the doctrine and you have the training which comes from that, Dhamma and vinaya. Later on in Buddhism, when the vinaya pitaka becomes established and comes into existence, initially there was no vinaya pitaka, there were just rules. The Buddha would lay down rules over time, and eventually this became the vinaya pitaka. So the word vinaya then got a slightly different meaning over time. Anyway, the way I see that, and of course you may disagree with that, that's fine, but anyway, I think it's just an interesting how to see, because we know that words evolve, we know that words change meaning over time, and this is how I regard what is happening here with the word vinaya. Anyway, that's a bit of an aside. We're actually talking about idle chatter, so I have to be careful not to get too far aside here. At the right time, he speaks such words that are worth recording. Worth recording, nidana vatting in Pali. Nidana in Pali, this is nidana with an A. It's not nidana as the source or something, but nidana as a treasure. So it is words that are treasurable, right? I really like this idea of words that are treasurable, words that when you hear them, you feel you want to kind of put them aside, right? And you want to keep them in your heart. You want to store them somewhere like a treasure and then take them out when you need them. These are the kind of words, this is what the suttas are like, right? Sometimes you come across beautiful little verses in the suttas, or a beautiful passage, or a beautiful simile, which is very meaningful to you. It may not be meaningful to other people, but it's meaningful to you. And you put it aside, you store it in your heart, and then you bring it out when the time is ripe to bring these things out. This is the kind of word we want to hear, right? These words that are treasurable. So you speak those words too, because when you speak that, sometimes people don't appreciate your treasures, right? I have all these treasures I want to give with others. They don't appreciate my treasures. Sometimes it is like that. And sometimes it's true. Sometimes people really don't appreciate. Even if you say something profound, people don't appreciate that. But that's okay. Or sometimes there will be people who appreciate that. And then, of course, it becomes very useful. Words that are reasonable, they are based on reason. They're not kind of just ideas or things that are not properly founded on something. They are moderate. Really, what it means here is that they are succinct, right? They have a certain... You don't just go on talking forever. There is a certain limit to what you say here. And then, lastly, they are beneficial. So they are beneficial for others, the words that you say. So there you are. That is right speech in Buddhism. And again, remember that we are trying to approach these things. Don't be too hard on yourself. I think it is always... If we raise the bar too high, we create too much suffering for ourselves. So remember, these are ideals. These are ideals that we're trying to live up to. And as we kind of stretch ourselves a little bit, we go a little bit more towards that ideal. And we get closer and closer and closer over time. And sometimes we fail. And if you fail, please forgive yourself. Don't be hard on yourself. Don't think that you are hopeless. You will never get anywhere. Because then you really become hopeless if you think you're hopeless. This is the problem. This becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy, as they say here. Because you get hard on yourself, you get negative, then you lose the positivity of the mind and you lose your ability to react to your mistakes in a good way. If you forgive yourself, you can reflect how can I do better in the future without just being harsh? How can I kind of turn this around? And then gradually you learn to improve yourself instead. So kindness is so important. Kindness to ourselves, forgiving our own weaknesses, understanding that we are conditioned beings, right? We are here because of all the conditions and things in the past. It's impossible to be perfect unless you are an arahant. So please do not expect perfection of yourself. So that is the very high standards of right speech, and very beautiful, especially when you read it in the positive way. Sometimes we always read these things in a negative way. Don't do this, don't do that. But I find it often more inspiring to read the positive side of these things than reading the negative side. So now I will go on to right action next. And this is how it is analyzed in this same sutta, which I'm coming back to again and again, in the Magga Sanghutta, Sanghutta Nikaya 45. And what, bhikkhus, is right action? Samma kamanta. Abstinence from the destruction of life. Abstinence from taking what is not given. Abstinence from sexual misconduct. This is called right action. And then again, returning to the Brahmins of Sala, the Salayaka Sutta, to get a bit more meat on those very bare bones. And this is what it says. Here, someone abandoning the killing of living beings, he abstains from killing living beings with rod and weapon laid aside, gentle and merciful. He abides compassionate to all living beings. So again, you can see here that there is always, in Buddhism, there is always, sila has a negative side, avoid the bad, and it has a positive side, do the good, right? Avoid hurting and killing living beings. But on the other hand, have compassion for them, be merciful, be kind, be of assistance if you can, support life wherever you have the opportunity, right? Two sides of the same coin, the good side and the bad side. And so please keep that in mind. And again, remember that here also it is about degrees. It's about the motivation that lies behind it, which makes something very bad or very good. If you kill something or somebody out of hatred or out of powerful greed or whatever, of course it is very, very bad. But perhaps there are circumstances where even killing can be done with a sense of compassion and kindness. Especially, I just mentioned euthanasia before. This is perhaps one example. There may also be other extreme examples where it is not so bad. So please, again, keep this in mind, that this is a graduated thing here. And really what we're trying to do is not just desperately to avoid killing, but to actually be kind and merciful and compassionate in the world. This is really what we are aiming for here. Then we have the next one here. Abandoning the taking of what is not given. In other words, abandoning stealing here. It's a very literal translation of the Pali, adinnadana, not taking of what is not given. I'm not sure why we don't just call it not stealing. I don't really know why, but this seems to have become the kind of usual way to translate this. I would probably say abandoning stealing. He abstains from stealing. He does not take by way of theft the wealth and property of others in the village or in the forest. This last part here, in the village or in the forest, is a little bit, you may wonder what that is all about. And that is actually where that comes from. It comes from the monastic rule. The second Parajika of the monks is actually written in this way. You don't take from the Gama or from the Aranya what is not given. And that's where it seems to have crept into this this particular sutta, the village and the forest. But I think actually it originally comes from the second Parajika of the monastic, of the Bhikkhu Patimokkha. And this is classic. This was a Parajika about not stealing. And there was some monks who stole something. And the Buddha said, okay, you cannot steal. And then there was always some bad monks, right? In those days, the bad monks were the group of six, right? You all know about the group of six, the Chabagia bhikkhu. And they were notoriously bad bhikkhus. They weren't really interested in monastic life, right? They were just hanging out in monastic life because it was a nice way of living. People give you food, right? And you can sort of have a good time. And they would break almost every conceivable rule. And then after the Buddha had laid down the rule, you cannot steal. If you steal, you become parajika, which means you're no longer a monk. Then these monks, they went into the forest and they stole something in the forest instead. And then the monk said, but hasn't the Buddha laid down a rule? You're not supposed to steal. But it wasn't from the village. It was from the forest. So it is okay. And then the Buddha has to lay down the rule. You cannot steal from the village, nor can you steal from the forest. Right? Can you imagine? You get a bit exasperated if you are the Buddha. These monks really don't get it. Right? This is the problem. If you're not really interested in the Dhamma, if you're not really interested in the practice, it is pointless to be a bhikkhu. Why on earth are you a bhikkhu? And this is why you try to get away with anything, right? And this is what happens. Anyway, that's where I think that little phrase is from. So, you do not take the property of others by way of theft. And it says elsewhere, there are a few different explanations of this, and it says elsewhere that by not stealing you abide in purity. If you steal, there's a sense of impurity there. If you don't steal, you feel pure about yourself. It is interesting that is specifically said about stealing, that gives that sense of impurity. So I guess that if you steal, there is a very strong sense there that you have done something wrong or whatever. Here it is interesting, there isn't really a very clear positive side. And the reason for that, of course, is that the positive side of stealing is generosity, right? That is what the positive side is. Now, generosity, as we have seen, is such an important part of the Buddhist path that is like taken out of this ordinary morality and sila and made into a separate factor, placed in the first factor as right view and is seen in many other places on the path as well as the foundational step of Buddhist practice. So that is why there isn't really a positive side to taking to stealing, because it is already there in generosity and talked about elsewhere. But certainly it is part, there is a positive side here as well. Then we have the last one. Abandoning misconduct in sensual pleasures. He abandons misconduct in sensual pleasures. He does not have intercourse with women who are protected by their mother, father, mother and father, brother, sister or relatives, who have a husband who are protected by the law, or with those who are garlanded in token of betrothal. In other words, they are engaged to be married. That's really what it means. So, again, this particular definition here is a very specific definition, but usually the definition is just kamesu michachara, and you avoid that. So you abandon kamesu michachara, which basically just means abandoning sexual misconduct. So what is sexual misconduct? It's just any kind of conduct which hurts other people, right? So a classic one would be, I think in the modern day, the classic one is like the infidelity. Having relationships outside of your commitment to your partner, whatever that might be, whether even if you're not married, you often have a commitment to somebody. So that would be kind of the basic one, because it is very painful when people do not live up to the commitment in marriage. It is so common. People, you know, when you're a monk, you hear about this all the time. People say, my husband is doing such and such. You know, what can I do about it? And wives do it too, right? Everybody does this kind of thing. Infidelity is a very, very common thing in the world. Lots of people do this. And it causes so much suffering. It causes so much pain. People really grieve over these things. And it's important to remember that when you do these kind of things, you cause tremendous pain to your partner. And it is very difficult to, often it can take years and years to overcome. Often it ends up in divorce and it ends up in all kind of problems, financial strife, you can't see your kids anymore. Tremendously bad consequences can come from this very simple thing here. So please don't allow yourself to be blinded. Sometimes we get blinded in a weak moment, but please keep these things very strongly in mind so you don't cause so much suffering for other people. So, and of course, there are other kinds of sexual misconduct that are much worse than just infidelity. Sexual misconduct with people who are too young or who are incapacitated, and all these kind of things are part of this. So, that is sexual misconduct, and it is only about that, only about a conduct which leads to the pain in other people. That is what it's about. It's not about any kind of mutual consent between adults. It is never about that. So, it opens up a very different view of what is moral and what is immoral in Buddhism compared to perhaps other more traditional ways of morality, especially in the Western world. Okay, so that is right action for you. And very briefly, towards the end, I will also have a quick look at right livelihood. There are so many suttas, I have to go a little bit quickly, unfortunately. Otherwise, again, we would be here, we won't be able to come get to the end. So very briefly on right livelihood. Again, back to the analysis sutta, the Vibhanga. And what, bhikkhus, is right livelihood? Samma ajiva. Here, a noble disciple, having abandoned a wrong mode of livelihood, earns his living by a right livelihood. This is called right livelihood. It's not all that helpful, right? It's like, so that's right livelihood. It's kind of just saying the same thing again, just in different words. So, for that reason, there is another sutta which talks about the right kind of trades that the layperson should engage in. So this gives a little bit more of flesh on what we are looking at. Because a lay follower should not engage in these five trades. What five? Trading in weapons, trading in living beings, trading in meat, trading in intoxicants, and trading in poisons. A lay follower should not engage in these five trades. So this means any trade where it leads to the harm of people or beings, that's essentially what it refers to, is a bad kind of trade. So you avoid trades that lead to harm. That is essentially what it is. And that kind of makes sense, right? If you are committed to right action, which is about not harming living beings, then of course you should live your livelihood in the same way. So samma kammanta leads naturally to samma ajiva. And for monastics, right livelihood is, again, it is explained in great length in the Brahmajala Sutta, the first sutta of the Digha Nikaya, has a long section called the Mahasila, the Majjhima Sila, which talks about the wrong kinds of livelihood, right? Acting like a doctor or prophesizing the future and these kind of things, right? It's not the kind of thing that you're supposed to do as a monk. What kind of livelihood do we have as a monk? Basically, it's practicing the Buddhist path. That is our livelihood. And when we practice the Noble Eightfold Path, people support us as a consequence. You could also say that giving Dhamma talks is a good thing to do. It's not really livelihood, because you don't really expect anything in return. But that is essentially the kind of things we do as monks. And not much more than that, right? And of course, helping people with giving some advice in difficult situations and these kind of things. But so that is really it. But the main thing for a monastic is just keeping the Patimokkha, practicing the right way. That is really the livelihood of a monastic. That is all. When we do that, then we become worthy of support according to how this works. So a quick last extract, so we're getting ready for right effort next time around. This is now from the Majjhima Nikaya 27. This is called the Chulahati Padopama Sutta in the Pali, the shorter sutta on the simile of the elephant's footprint. And this was the sutta I did here 2 years ago when I came here last time. I did that in length, and now I just have a few extracts from that sutta. And this is a beautiful way of looking at the monastic life, in a sense, the monastic livelihood. And this is the Buddha speaking here. He becomes content with the robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out taking only these with him. Just as a bird, whatever it flies with its wings as its only burden, So too the bhikkhu or the bhikkhuni becomes content with the robes to protect the body and with alms food to maintain the stomach. And wherever he or she goes, he sets out taking only these with him. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, he experiences with himself a bliss that is blameless. So this is like the ideal of the monastic life, right? It is very rarely these days that people live up to this kind of ideal. But sometimes you find monastics that do live up to this ideal, and it's very kind of beautiful. All you have in the whole world is just your robe and bowl, and then you wander around receiving alms food wherever alms food is available. That's all you do. And this is called, this passage is called the passage on contentment, on santuti in the suttas. And you can see that if you are content in this way, if you're happy just to have an alms bowl, you're happy just to have your robes, it means you have very few desires, right? So this is why this passage on contentment is like now we're moving over from the ordinary sila, the sammakamanta, the sammavacha, the ordinary external sila, and we're starting to move into the sila of the mind. This is what is happening here. And of course, the sila of the mind means the overcoming of greed, hatred, and delusion gradually, stage by stage. And this is the beginning of that. Because if you are content, you have very few desires. You have very little in the thing that you want in the world. So we are moving now towards the sila of the mind. Already at this point, you have achieved quite a lot in terms of reducing those desires. It's quite inspiring, actually, although it is very rarely lived these days. I have heard of monks who live like this. I think one of the famous monks who was here in Sri Lanka, he was a German monk, Venerable Jnana Vimala, who many of you have probably heard of. And he was just like that. He was a monk. I don't know how he did this. He came from Germany, right? This was in the 1930s or something, a long, long time ago. Probably some of you can correct me on my knowledge of this monk. But this time nobody knew much about Buddhism. And he comes to Sri Lanka, right, from Germany. And he practices like this for 30, 40 years, just wandering, just with his bowl and robe, never really knowing where he's going to go next. Then settling down for the rains retreat, finding a place to meditate and wandering on. So he is one of the few examples that I know of anywhere who actually practiced in this particular way. And he, towards the end of his life, he was known to have, many people thought he was an Arya. Some people thought he was an Arahant even. He was very, very highly acclaimed. I know that Ajahn Brahm, my teacher, he met him on one occasion, and Ajahn Brahm was very, very impressed with this particular monk. He thought he certainly seemed to be somebody very special. Anyway, so it can be done, but obviously it is not. It is very rare for these things to happen. So this is the contentment, right? Now we're moving towards the mind, how the working of the mind. And then very last thing it says in here, it says, possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, you experience within yourself the bliss that is blameless, the anavajja sukha. Vajja is a fault, right? You've done a mistake, it's a fault. Anavajja, anna is the negative, non-fault. Anavajja sukha, non-fault bliss, non-fault happiness. What is that? It is when there's nothing to regret, right? You look inside of yourself, you have no actions to regret. If you regret things, you feel a sense of remorse. You feel a sense of, I should have done better. But now, you have no regrets anymore. In fact, when you think about your conduct, when you think about your life, you feel a sense of joy, a sense of happiness instead. That is the anavajja sukha. So this is where the happiness on the path starts to arise and comes to the fore. I was talking about happiness before, the importance of happiness as we practice meditation. And here is the first time the Buddha talks about happiness. And this happiness is something that he comes back to again and again. As the path progresses, each time the path progresses, the happiness becomes more profound. But this is like the beginning of that happiness. Okay, so that is plenty enough for this morning. And This afternoon we will continue with the next factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is Sammapadana, and we will spend quite a lot of time looking at that particular factor. So I'll see you again this afternoon here.